But this is David. You're tuned to WPKN at 89.5 FM in Detroit. It's the first Sunday night of the month, and it's we got the In Context crew in the studio. How about that? And Ken McDermott Rowe is here, as well as March McDermott Rowe. And good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Yeah, thanks for having us here.
And we're going to get started right away. What's going on tonight?
Well, this is In Context. As Dave said, we are on the first Sunday of the month at 10 o'clock and on the first Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. And tonight I have with Gus Contivero, who my fellow host can't be with us. He's on vacation, but I'm happy to be joined by In Context military affairs commentator March McDermott Rowe. And you can read his blogs and the blogs that Gus and I write at incontextreport.com. March's latest blog is entitled Iran, Israel, China, and World War III. Now, there have been many important stories in the last couple of weeks. Everyone's been, I'm sure, aware of the July 22nd Norway terrorist attacks. We're also, some of you may have read about the horrible loss of 31 U.S. Soldiers and a shooting down of an American helicopter in Afghanistan, which is said to be the largest loss in a single incident in the 10 years of the war. And of course, many of you followed the increase to the debt ceiling, which is almost a debacle in Congress, and the subsequent downgrade of U.S. debt by Standard & Poor's from AAA to AA+. But one of the stories, the story we're going to start out with tonight, is an extremely important story that I think has been almost completely ignored by the corporate media, and that is the report that Israel, like the reports that Israel is planning an attack on Iran shortly, perhaps in September. And March, I'd like you to, if we could, to get into tonight the nature of these reports, and also if we could talk about the various scenario, how this might play out if Israel, in fact, attacks Iran. So let's start out by talking about a report by Mr. Robert Baer, the CIA veteran. Could you talk about his report?
Well, firstly, I'd like to say that a lot of people can make accusations that these are conspiracy theories, or there's no sound evidence that. No matter what anyone says, Robert Baer is a renowned CIA operative, CIA agent, who served honorably for an entire career with the Central Intelligence Agency, has numerous contacts within governments and intelligence agencies around the world, and his source for a planned Israeli attack on Iran is none other than the Israeli Mossad. So right away, you're starting out with a very solid base of evidence. This is more than just conjecture. This is more than just opinion.
What will be attacked by Israel, according to his information, and when will the attack take place?
It appears, and this is information corroborated by, believe it or not, the Russian ambassador to NATO, that Israel is planning on targeting Iran's nuclear facilities this coming fall, most likely September or October.
The nuclear facilities. And you mentioned that his sources were inside the Mossad, and I see from the article on it, which I have, Al Jazeera, he mentions that the name of a former Mossad chief, Meir Dagan.
Yes. His sources are not, as I said, they're not... it's not up for conjecture. His sources are high-level people within the Mossad. And these individuals have been – the reason why they've broken the story is because they feel that it's too much of a gamble. There are two camps within Israel right now. There is a good portion of the ruling Kadima party, what used to be the Likud party, founded by – well, predominantly led by Ariel Sharon until his incapacitation and the formation of the Likud party – Kadima party. And that camp believes that the best solution right now to the fact that they are being hemmed in by Arab revolutions, the growing power of Iran, the growing power of Hezbollah, and the suppression of the revolution in Syria, that the best response for Israel is a preemptive strike, which hopefully in their mind's eye would draw the United States and NATO in on their side and at the very least squash these emerging threats around them. The other camp feels that this is too premature. I mean, let's face it, the United States right now is militarily in no position to take on the major powers in the region, not to mention the fact that Russia has a mutual defense treaty with Iran, so it could invariably lead to a confrontation with Russia, which most of the Western powers don't want either.
So the Al Jazeera article indicates that there are a great many, actually a majority of the former top people at the Mossad are very upset about the prospect of this attack. And you alluded to the fact that a NATO envoy, Russia's envoy to NATO, Dmitry Rogozin, he says that NATO is planning a military strike against Iran to overthrow the Iranian government. So it's coming from the information is coming from this other source. Well, let's another point that should bear in mind is that this possible attack by Israel upon Iran is taking place as Palestine, in its frustration over its inability to move forward with the peace negotiations with Israel, has decided to bring its case for a statehood to the United Nations, where it's going to seek membership probably in September. And what the Russian envoy says is that the Israeli attack on Iran the NATO attack on Iran may be to forestall consideration of this extremely important measure. And what do you say about that?
Well, I think it connects directly, more than anything right now, with the Israeli psychology, which Israel has always had very much the bunker mentality. I mean, they are surrounded by hostile neighbors. They've been surrounded by hostile neighbors since 1948. And so the notion that not only – I mean, after the Arab revolutions, they lost feasibly almost every – not necessarily ally, but every friendly Arab dictator. And now they're being replaced, what it looks like, with nationalist leaders in many circumstances. I mean, certainly General Tantawi in Egypt is not the pushover that Mubarak was. He's opened up the Suez Canal to Iranian warships. So –
The political climate in the region is making an adverse turn from their point of view. In addition, I saw in a paper recently that over 100 nations have now recognized the state of Palestine within 1967 borders, which would, of course, mean that the Israeli settlements in the West Bank would be illegal.
Exactly. I mean, to be honest, well, anyone, and whether they support the state of Israel or not, knows that settlements in a foreign country are illegal. There's just no question about that. Because, I mean, let's face it, if settlements were legal, permissible, then the Chinese could just come and settle, you know, they got 1 billion people in a tiny plot of land. Why don't they just settle half of their population in the unused parts of the United States? It's an absurd concept.
So the problem
stems, though, from the fact that the recognition of the state will now force them back to the 67 borders and put them in what they believe to be a strategically untenable position. So they're almost on death ground, if you will.
So this is a bit put. Israel now, as I understand it, has about 300,000 settlers in the West Bank, which is, I think, under international law, illegal, but it's a reality on the ground. Those people are living there. They've built communities. And this has happened really since the Camp David Accords. There was a negligible number of settlers there back in the late 70s. And now it's a very huge presence. So I don't see how this situation could evolve. So in any kind of peaceful way, it would be a very dangerous situation if we move ahead, we see the UN move ahead with the inclusion of Palestine. And as I mentioned, over 100 nations now have recognized Palestinian statehood. Now let's move to the worst scenario. Let us suppose that Israel launches airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facilities. Is it possible that there will be no response, as there was by Syria when Israel launched an air attack on Syria recently? Is that one scenario?
This is a completely different situation from Syria. Syria, the al-Assad family has always been, they've held a very tight control on power. They've had spouted anti-Israel rhetoric. They've been pro-Iran. They supported known terrorist groups in Lebanon, but they've lacked the military capacity that Iran has, as well as the Russian support. One thing that Iran has done, which I think is very interesting, there was an interesting historical precedent set during the Arab-Israeli War of 1973. Egypt had a far inferior air force to that of Israel. Israel was equipped with a state-of-the-art U.S. Phantom jets, British Harriers. I mean, they had phenomenal aircraft. So the Egyptians knew they could never go toe-to-toe with the Israeli Air Force. So instead of fighting them on a linear battlefield, what by military doctrine we are used to, they decided we're going to go around their advantage. So they set up surface-to-air missile sites all along the Suez Canal. So the Egyptian soldiers storm Suez. They land on the other side. The Israeli Air Force counterattacks and is blown out of the sky. It was a massive defeat for the Israeli Air Force. What defeated the Egyptians ultimately was the fact they left the protection of those surface-to-air missile screens. Now, that having been said, Iran recently was given by Russia 29, unless I'm mistaken, 29 surface-to-air missile systems. Now, these surface-to-air missile systems coming from Russia, again, you know, we have this misconception that Russia is this collapsed power from the Soviet days. But it's not. They've spent a lot of time investing in technology to counter our air capabilities. And they've been giving these to Iran because Iran knows it doesn't have jets that can go toe-to-toe with ours. So the first thing they would do is try to shoot down these aircraft. And whether they succeeded or not, Iran also has a much larger military than Syria. Iran has a standing army of over 1 million and the ability to call up an additional 7 million-man militia.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe, and you've just been listening to the In Context military affairs commentator, March McDermott Rowe. If you'd like to join our conversation, and we're talking about latest developments in the global war, including the possibility that Israel may attack Iran, please give us a call at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756 to join the conversation on In Context and WPKN.
I really fundamentally feel that Iran is in a militarily much better position. Again, also receiving a tremendous amount. The Russian T-90, which I believe is the latest tank, is, as far as most military analysts are concerned, capable of going toe-to-toe with the American M1 Abrams, as well as the Israeli Merkava tank.
And these, who has the right? Do the Iranians have this?
The Iranians possess this technology.
Okay, let's assume that an air attack goes forth. It's directed from Israel. It's directed at the nuclear facilities in Iran. What did the Iranians do in response? What does the United States do?
The first response by the United States, whether we are aware that an attack is going to take place or not, is irrelevant. We are obligated to come in on the side of Israel in this instance. Iran's first response under this circumstance would be rhetoric, calling on support from her allies, from the Russians, namely who? The Russians, and most people don't know this, but look it up. It is a fact. Russia signed a mutual defense treaty with Iran, which stipulates that if Iran is attacked, Russia will come to Iran's defense. It is a fact, folks. You can't get around that. And so Iran's first strategy would be to call on Russia for help. It would also be to strike our ships and our shipping in the Persian Gulf. Iran possesses a missile which was developed in connection with the Chinese aeronautics industry. Again, the Chinese and the Russians have the same interests in the region. It's whatever combats
our
interests.
And they have a defense pact as well, the Russians and the Chinese?
The Russians and the Chinese have a defense pact, as well as, interestingly enough, Venezuela, Brazil, and Cuba. Venezuela, Bolivia, and Cuba also have defense treaties with Russia.
So theoretically, an attack on Iran, China, Russia, and these other countries could invoke their treaty and be at war with Israel and possibly the United States, the way that we invoked the NATO treaty in the case of Afghanistan after the World Trade Center bombing. We said it was an attack upon the United States and told our European allies they had to go to war with Afghanistan as well.
Precisely. I mean, no matter how you cut it, again, I am bipartisan, like Israel or don't like Israel. The way it's going to come off is a preemptive strike is a preemptive strike.
So now you're the president. You're the president. You get word. Let's say we're not notified in advance of this attack. What do you do?
Your immediate response is to ask Israel what they need and watch as things develop. Because, you know, you need to remember we have 50,000 U.S. troops, roughly give or take a dozen or six, in Iraq. And so any attack would immediately affect our forces in the region. So the first step would be to put our forces in the region on high alert, and it would be to ultimately ask the Israelis what's going on and what do you need? How can we mitigate this situation and watch for the Iranian response? I mean, if the Iranians start hitting our ships in the Persian Gulf with this new missile, this missile that they developed in connection with the Chinese aeronautics industry is nicknamed the carrier killer because it's capable of striking a ship 1,000 miles out to sea. It flies only feet above the water, so it can't be picked up by radar or sonar because it's above the water, and sinking aircraft carriers. And it's capable of being launched either from land or attack boats.
We've discussed before the idea that America is very heavily invested in the aircraft carrier, but that this may be an obsolete technology. Could you expand on that?
It's aircraft carriers. The best example is battleships during World War II. Battleships to World War II are what aircraft carriers are today. They are anachronistic, but our Navy, just like the Royal Navy was during World War II, and just like our Navy was during World War II, is caught up on the idea of the battleship being central to naval warfare. We're caught up on the idea that the aircraft carrier is central. The aircraft carrier is anachronistic. I mean, in the age of the jet and the submarine and these missiles that can strike ships from land and from attack boats, if you have the capability of destroying an aircraft carrier from a small speedboat zipping across the ocean, really, it negates the importance of the aircraft carrier. The whole purpose of the aircraft carrier was to project your air power. But now we have jets that can fly around the world without the need for aircraft carriers. They've just become anachronistic.
So if our aircraft carriers were disabled in the Persian Gulf, and the Persian Gulf is a relatively small area, so I'm guessing that this would be make it difficult, make it relatively easier for the Iranians to attack.
Of course, and these weapons being very mobile, you couldn't just, unlike Scud missiles, which are very large and very bulky, these things are smaller and more mobile. I mean, if you look at photographs of them, they're actually surprisingly small.
So the idea of I'm sorry, go ahead.
But they could be moved around very easily, and because of the narrowness of the Persian Gulf, you might not see them coming until they've hit your ship.
Now, you mentioned, you talked about Iraq. That situation is probably very key because when we invaded Iraq, we displaced the Sunni government, and basically the Sunnis have pretty largely been purged from Iraq, and so there's now a Shiite government, a collaborator government, but over a predominantly Shiite country now. How would they behave in the event of an Israeli attack on Iran?
Well, a key factor to remember is in the Shia doctrine, in the Islam, there are two schools of thought. There's the Orthodox Islam, and there's the Shia doctrine. The Shia believe that the head, they are very similar. A good comparison is that of the Catholic Church. They have the head of their sect is in Iran. He is the great leader of Iran. He is the ultimate figurehead above the president. All Shia hold an ultimate loyalty, and I've known this because I've known many Shia in my day. Nice people, but their ultimate loyalty is first and foremost to the grand Ayatollah in Iran. And so the first thing that would happen under such a circumstance, the government in Iraq might flip-flop. They might, you know, stand on the fence because they don't want to be on the losing side. But predominantly, the army would not, they wouldn't fight against Iran. They wouldn't fight against other Shia. Least of all, and this is the biggest problem, is Muqtada as-Sadr and his Mahdi army.
Now, he's the leader of the Shia community in Iraq?
Not officially, but he is the spiritual head because his father was murdered by Saddam, so he's a Shia martyr to the Shia community. His father was a martyr. He's the son of a martyr. And
did he make a statement today that if the United States stays beyond 2011 in Iraq, that his group will take up arms?
Yes, he did. You can find this on Al Jazeera English, and you can find this on the BBC as well as PressTV.ir.
Would Iran attack Iraq, seeing it as a U.S. possession in the course of a conflict? Would they do so in anticipation that the Iraqi army might stand down? How do you think that might develop?
I think what most likely would happen, because the Iraqi army, I can guarantee you, is going to stand down. I mean, one of the biggest mistakes we made was to fire all of the Sunni, because we assumed that since we fire all the Ba'athist, we get rid of all the pro-Saddam people. It was asinine and idiotic. But the fact of the matter is that they are not, the Iraqi army, the Shia, are not going to turn against other Shia. It's just, it's not going to happen. So the Iraqi army is not going to intervene. Most likely, if war were to break out, Iran, the Grand Ayatollah, would give the go-ahead for Muqtada as-Sadr and his Mahdi army, who are veterans of fighting the United States, very well armed, very well trained, and would give them the go-ahead to start attacking U.S. forces in Iraq, bypassing the Iraqi troops and harassing us because we're hemmed in our fobs.
You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. March McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, has been talking about the possibility that Israel may attack Iran, setting off a larger war in the Mideast. And if you'd like to ask questions, make comments, please give us a call at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. So what about on another front? What about on Lebanon? Hezbollah, what religion are the members of Hezbollah? How would they react in the event of an Israeli attack on Iran?
Hezbollah is an interesting situation because unlike the Mahdi army, Muqtada as-Sadr, which is purely a Shia movement, Hezbollah, while dominated by Shia, is a non-sectarian, nominally, organization. They have the support of the Sunni community in Lebanon, for the most part. Hezbollah's leadership, though, is Shia, and their first allegiance is to, again, Iran, also because that's where their founders got their education from. That's where their founders got their support from. That's where Hezbollah gets all its arms from and all its training. They can't turn their back on Iran. Iran says jump. Hezbollah has to ask.
Would take their cue from Iran. If Iran absorbed the air attacks from Israel and did nothing, Hezbollah probably would do nothing. But then if Iran retaliated, then Hezbollah would go into action. Is that
Hezbollah most likely would strike immediately. The thing is that an attack on Iran by Israel will also result, most likely, in my research, would be an attack on Lebanon as well. Israel, in the last several days, had launched numerous flyovers, violations, mind you, of Lebanese airspace. Like I say, pro-Israeli or not pro-Israeli, doesn't matter. It was a violation of Lebanese airspace, and the fact is Hezbollah did not shoot at the planes. My guess is what these are, reconnaissance. It would make the most sense.
Acquiring targets.
Because the fact of the matter is, the moment Israel strikes Iran, Hezbollah can hammer major Israeli cities with well-aimed rockets.
How far could Hezbollah reach inside Israel?
They can hit Haifa. I'm not sure if they have, depending on the level, I don't know how much their level of technology has increased from what they've obtained from Iran. They might be able even to hit as far south as Tel Aviv.
Another wrinkle on the Lebanese situation is the change in the politics since the overthrow of Mubarak. Has to do with the Suez Canal, the movement of ships from Iran into the Mediterranean, right?
That has greatly increased Hezbollah's capability. Again, after the revolution, Egypt shut down the canal during a period and opened it back up. Now, traditionally, Mubarak's regime said, we will not allow any Iranian warships through, because Mubarak wanted to be on good terms with Israel. The Tantawi government, the military government in charge in Egypt now, opened up the canal to Iranian warships, in great part because Egypt is insanely unstable right now, and the last thing they wanted was to have a very angry Iran try to destabilize them, as Iran did in Iraq, as Iran did in many other parts of the world, in places like Bahrain and places like that, Yemen. So Egypt was really, if anything, a survivalist theory. It was, let's not get on anybody's bad side. So allowing these warships through allowed them to deliver weapons directly to Lebanon, and that's what Israeli intelligence services have said.
And now also Russia has access to the Mediterranean through its ally Syria. As long as Al-Assad's in power, would the Russian military play any role, do you think, in a conflict between Israel and Iran?
Absolutely, because of the mutual defense treaty. I think most of their forces would be focused in Iran proper. There was an article I read in Pravda, and this is going many years back. This is back in like 2005. And Russia claimed that it had sent 50,000 soldiers to station them in Iran. I think certainly Russia would get involved. They would try to minimize their overt presence, depending on how badly or how well the war went. One has to remember, Russia hates having hostile neighbors on its doorstep. That's why they befriended Ukraine and Belarus, and even after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And they've made every effort to control Georgia and Azerbaijan and all these countries because they do not like feeling hemmed in. And what NATO and the U.S. are trying to do now is we are trying to hem in Russia in Europe and the Middle East, and we're trying to push China out of Africa.
That's what we've Rick Rozoff, who's been our guest a few times and in context, the global military strategist, has documented so well with the expansion of NATO throughout the world in military alliances that now encompass something like a quarter of the members of the United States, the United Nations, that we effectively encircling Russia and China in order to create, obviously, a world hegemony and, in particular, domination over the Eurasian continent. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're at 203-336-9756. The name of the program is In Context, and you're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Now, let's suppose that this thing turns into a big war, and Iran were to send troops into Iraq. What would that mean to the 50,000 U.S. troops in Iraq? And how could the United States respond by bringing in more ground troops?
I think we'd have to. I mean, the thing is, we are not going to just give up Iraq, and we are not going to just give up 50,000 troops. We can't. I mean, as much as we may like to think that, oh, well, we'll just destroy them from the air, that's not a reality. You're talking about a well-equipped army, so you're looking at this would result in a brutal slogging match. But the fact of the matter is, we cannot just up and leave, because if we do, our international prestige will be ruined. I mean, the fact that we can't get rid of Gaddafi as hard as we've been trying is wounded our international prestige. The fact that we've done nothing about al-Assad has even more so wounded our international prestige, so we would have no choice but to commit more troops. My guess, though, and you have to realize this, the United States Army, and I'm talking just about the Department of the Army, consists of a little over 1 million men. Our entire military is roughly a little over 1.5 million. We only have 80,000 U.S. Marines. If you think about that, the entire U.S. Marine Corps is only 80,000 strong. Iran, Russia, Lebanon, these countries all have numbers on us. We have 300 military bases around the world, each requiring commitments of U.S. troops. We have 40,000 troops in Korea. We have 50,000 in Japan. We have another 50,000 in Germany. Not to mention our commitments in Romania, Georgia, places all over the world, Colombia even. And so,
well, if one looks at the U.S. Military game plan around the world today, it seems to be emphasis on technology as the winner. especially the increased use of the drones, which we're now using, I understand, in Somalia and in Yemen. Actually, we're fighting in six wars now around the, which people probably aren't aware, many people are not aware of. That, so we think that technology can bring victory. And I guess the question, one of the questions would be, in the Pentagon, are they thinking, well, we don't want this war against Iran, but if it starts, we can knock them flat from the air and end it. Do you think that's a reasonable, do we have a caller? Oh, please go ahead. You're on the air on In Context with Ken McDermott Rowe and March McDermott Rowe.
Hi. This is a really interesting conversation. I don't hear these kind of things discussed on any other radio station, like mainstream radio. There's so many issues discussed. Firstly, I think that the publications that are cited are very interesting, whether it's Press, TV, and the other one, Pravda.
Al Jazeera was there. That was where the Mr. Baer was reported on his interview. I believe was on in a Los Angeles radio station, one of the Pacifica Network stations.
Yeah, well, and you know,
KPFK in Los Angeles.
Right. Most people have heard of Al Jazeera, but if you look at where people get their information from, few Americans actually venture out. Like, if you were to read the English versions of the Iranian newspaper or the Russian newspaper on a daily basis, it's interesting because you would not get any point of view that is pro-American or pro-Israel at all. There's no risk of that. And you can actually learn different things that are going on. But it was interesting, a comment about how trying to hem Russia in. There was an article that came out, I think today or yesterday, saying that the war with Georgia, basically, there's an allegation that the Russians are saying that the United States was involved with that. And I was wondering, what interest would the United States have in the country of Georgia? Why were they involved with that country?
Well, I mean, Georgia for the longest time was considered to be a very strong ally. And it's because it was a former Soviet republic. We, after the fall of the Soviet Union, tried to make very close with Russia's former Confederates, because the idea was that this way we would prevent Russia from becoming a strong opponent again. If we had troops in Kazakhstan, if we had troops in Romania, if we had troops in Bulgaria, in Poland, the Ukraine and Georgia, it would force Russia into a corner whereby it would be very difficult for them to challenge our authority. That's also was the importance of Russia invading Georgia. It was to send a message that we will launch a preemptive war against anyone we want, the same as you launched a preemptive war in Iraq. We can launch one against any one of your allies.
It's also about the pipeline route, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. There is a pipeline that travels down from the Caucasus through Georgia down into the Middle East.
Right.
And that pipeline's very important, who ultimately controls that pipeline. But I think the most significant part was it was a very strong message to the Western powers, because they could have always used much more covert methods to get rid of the president of Georgia and his government. And it was the fact that they didn't drive onto Tbilisi. They stopped intentionally halfway through after destroying the Georgian fleet on dry dock, to send a message to the West that we are going to hit back. We're not going to let you hem us in. We are not weak anymore. We are not the weak, collapsed state of just after the fall of the Soviet Union. We are strong again.
A caller, you'd mentioned press TV and Russian news sources. Are you personally casting the net wider in your search for news?
I'm making a comment, not a question, that, you know, if there's a war, we're obviously at war, and I like your comment that it's true that we're at war with at least six countries because we're dropping drone Hellfire missiles from in all those countries. And it would be interesting to see what other points of view are out there. So it's a comment that I think most people get their news from the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and Fox TV and CNN. But we don't ever get a chance to hear other points of view.
I think that's so true, caller. And I know personally, I watch, for example, BBC World quite a bit, and I think excellent coverage. But and I listen to NPR, too, I should say. The quality of the coverage diminishes greatly when it has to do with the war in which the United States or Britain is involved. When the quality goes right down the toilet, and you're much better off.
NPR, if you notice the NPR, they have a lot of breaking news that comes from the military, and they have a lot of clearance on that. I would be interested to find out how many times that, you know, whether, how connected they are. And like in Italy, they have three different national radio stations, Rai 1, 2, and 3, and they're connected to different political spectrums. We're kind of like a one-dimensional society, one national radio station. And it's kind of pathetic.
Yes.
So, yeah, when it comes to war footage, I don't listen to any. I can't listen to the BBC. I don't look at The Guardian or the Daily Telegraph or anything. I got to look at other sources. But I want to touch on one thing, because it's very interesting, the point that you're saying about Hezbollah in Lebanon and Sadr in Iraq, because it's kind of like the final point of the American influence in the world, which we thought that, you know, I guess we're doing 300 nightly raids in Afghanistan, so it's drone, airplanes, and nightly raids, which is really the military policy of counterinsurgency, which, of course, I don't know that we've won any counterinsurgency anywhere in the world in the past 60 years, but yet we're still going along with it. But it's interesting to note that Hezbollah stopped Israel and Sadr stopped the United States. And I was wondering if the guests could talk about that how have they been able to do that militarily to the point where Sadr actually forced, is the only reason why the United States military stay in Iraq is not clear right now, because they're supposed to leave at the end of the year, and the Iraqi government is dependent upon what Sadr says on this. Isn't that the case? And what's your comments on that? And I'm going to hang up. And thank you so much for my call.
Thank you for your call, caller.
Thank you very much. I think certainly Israel, when they invaded Lebanon, had an immense amount of arrogance. They felt that they were fighting a unconventional army, a poorly disciplined, poorly trained militia. They were coming in. I mean, it was the first field test, really, of the Israelis' new Merkava tank, which admittedly is, I think, one of the few tanks in the world that's superior to the M1A1 Abrams, which is the mainline battle tank of the United States military. The problem that the Israelis had is they woefully underestimated the military preparedness, the training, and the equipment that Hezbollah possessed. What happened is instead of trying to combat the Israeli army by driving out there with other tanks, Hezbollah ambushed the Israeli tank convoys, blew the tanks up from behind. One thing that's interesting is the Merkava tanks are, and this is no military secret, I mean, any military history buff can look this up, the fuel tanks for the Merkava are in the rear. So all the Hezbollah fighters knew they had to do was fire a RPG up the rear of the vehicle, and they'd destroy it. So that's what they did. And they harassed the Israeli military, the entire advance up, to the point that it floundered. And charging up the Bekaa Valley, which is one of the main valleys up Lebanon, the Israeli tank convoys were ambushed, stalled. They tried a second time up a different valley, got stalled again. So then they just launched a persistent air campaign until they could say, we've accomplished our objectives and we're leaving.
You're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM. And Dave, do we have time to take another call if someone out there? The phone number here, if you'd like to join our conversation or ask a question, is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. But I'm sorry, March, you were saying about the Lebanese situation. You're right about the Israeli attack, a recent attack on Lebanon.
Oh, yes. And so, I mean, it was, and so the Israelis felt that they would try to win a war by attrition, just by bombing the Beirut and the major Lebanese cities into a pulp. And I think one thing that's very interesting, a comment this caller made, which I think is very important, was the coverage of the war in Lebanon. I have a very dear friend of mine named Rana. She's a nurse in a hospital in Beirut, and I corresponded with her during the bombing of Beirut. And what was amazing, and this is something not covered by any of the major media outlets, the extensive flattening of especially the poorer districts of Beirut in order to hopefully, because that's where Hezbollah garners a lot of its support, in order to break the back of Hezbollah, and it failed miserably. The Hezbollah fighters, it just emboldened them. They kept harassing the Israeli forces and stalled the invasion completely. That's what really, it was a sense of a third world army breaking the back of a first world army.
How long would it, we've been talking about a scenario if Israel goes ahead with the attacks that have been reported or being planned on Iran, that Iran may respond in a very strong way and it lead to a wider conflict. How long do you think it would take for this to evolve? Would there be time for, say, the United States to reinstitute a draft to get large numbers of people over to the conflict area? Or would this be over in 72 hours and we could never really do anything about it?
I think the sad statement is if we were lucky, it would be over in 72 hours. But the fact of the matter is, the Israeli army are no pushovers, but neither is the Iranian army, and neither are the U.S. forces stationed in Iraq. Again, like I said, for the sake of international prestige, we are not going to pull those troops out if war breaks out. Those troops are going to stay and fight. It will be a brutal slogging match. We could feasibly possibly win it. We could win it, but it will be a sloggy match, which will require the commitment of hundreds of thousands of U.S. forces.
Yeah, again, if we are relying heavily on air power, I guess one question would be, would if Israel and then the United States joined in, inflicted enough pain on the Iranians by bombing their cities that they might eventually just have enough of the war and withdraw?
One thing I think I must point out is that bombing somebody's cities has never ever in the history of the world broken their will. We flattened Dresden during World War II. That wasn't what broke the will of the Germans. What broke the will of the Germans was the fact they ran out of gas for their tanks. What broke the will of the Germans was the fact that we just had more troops than they did. The fact is, if we start bombing the major Iranian cities, it is going to make them very, very angry, and it is going to embolden them. It is not going to break their will. Instead, you will have young men lining up in the droves to charge American positions. It's just, bombing the major cities doesn't work. In fact, actually, General David Petraeus, a very well-known commander, he's now head of the CIA, really the architect of U.S. successes in Iraq, stated that, in essence, he said in his book on counterinsurgency, wars cannot be won only from the air. You need, and I'm oversimplifying this, but he said in essence, you need boots on the ground to provide presence, to provide security, and you need troops to fight the enemy troops. You need to see the enemy and you need to defeat him. You can't just try to bomb him from the air. War doesn't work that way. As much as we may live in this Star Wars fantasy that we can just bomb our enemy into oblivion with these high-tech, point-name bombs. And
well, of course, all of this conflict, if a larger conflict goes on, just the conflicts that are taking place at the moment, are draining our economy. And as we saw when we had this deficit, the national debt increased recently and the struggle over trying to reduce our deficit, the United States is in very dire shape financially. So certainly an additional war is something we wouldn't want from an economic point of view. But even more so, we don't want to see more people killed, Americans or foreign people killed. So I would say to members of the audience who are as concerned as we are, and that's why we're talking about it tonight, even that's why we're bringing it to your attention, even though the corporate media has pretty much missed this story, that you should contact your elected representative and express your concern that countries, the leaders of the countries, exercise restraint, whether it's in Israel or the United States or Iran, that we don't want to see a wider conflict. In fact, we would like to see less conflict. I think the United States should, and this really ties into the debt ceiling discussion, the United States should be, I think we should be closing down the American empire. I think it's time for the American people to say, look, we want to be republic again, and we want to take all this money we've been spending on wars all around the world and start investing in the United States to revive our economy, because that's the real answer. I see these guys in Washington wringing their hands. What can we do? What can we do? And they talk about cutting Social Security, which was quite deceptive, because there is a Social Security Trust Fund. They talk about cutting medical care and other social welfare spending. And the answer is quite obvious. You start with closing down the American empire and reopening the American republic, ending these six wars we're involved in, closing some of the 700 or most of the 700 military bases we have around the world, according to Chalmers Johnson, and starting to invest in America and the things that make a country rich, which is infrastructure, investing to create good paying jobs and make our economy more competitive. So I would like, if people are concerned about this issue, if they could go ahead and contact their elected representatives and say they would like to see this country move in the direction of peace and progress.
Well, and I think a very important thing.
We have a call.
Oh, we have a caller?
Listener. Hello, listener. You're on the air.
Yeah, I have another question. What you mentioned about Petraeus and the violence going down in Iraq, but the violence went down in Iraq because of the so-called Awakening Council, which consisted of paying people not to shoot at Americans anymore. And I believe that this is the same policy that they wanted to use in Afghanistan. Can you speak to this policy of the Awakening Council and whether that, although the violence diminished, it only stays down as long as you can pay people to not shoot at American soldiers? Can you speak to that and how that policy, if that was used in Afghanistan, and what chance there is of success for that,
Colin,
in Afghanistan?
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I mean, certainly that was, again, one of the things that General Petraeus was a big supporter of was the Awakening Council. And certainly the idea of paying people not to shoot at us is as old as time. The Brits did it when they were in Afghanistan. That was actually the only thing they found successful, was to put the Afghan chieftains on subsidies to pay them not to shoot at the British soldiers. And when they couldn't continue to pay the subsidies, then they were their ambassador was brought into the office of the emir, Dost Mohammed, who then shot the ambassador. You know, the Afghan idea of negotiations. They're tough people. But in Iraq, it works much better because you have a very modern society and politicians can always be bribed. Leaders can always be bribed. The Afghans are much, much harder to deal with because you can't just bribe their leaders. You have to give them dignity and autonomy, because there's nothing – Afghans are independent from each other as much as they are from the government. And so to say to the Afghan leaders, we'll pay you these bribes, but now you have to swear allegiance to Kabul – It doesn't work that way. When they had a central government at one stage, as I mentioned, their emir was Dost Mohammed, and his policy was that you govern yourselves. We come together to go sack Lahore, and then, which is in Pakistan, and then, you know, and then we all go back home with all this loot and everything, and then you just, you know, you don't pay taxes. There's no central army. There's no really central government, so to speak. It was a loose confederation. So we kept this very alien Western idea of you're going to have a parliament, you're going to have a government, and you're all going to have to swear allegiance to that, but we'll pay you. Afghans don't work that way. They need their dignity and they need their independence.
What's the famous quote by Churchill?
Winston Churchill famously said that in Afghanistan, every man's hand is against the other and all against the outsider. The only thing that has ever in history united Afghans is hatred of their invader. And something I'd like to point out to the everyone listening tonight: Russia had a million men in Afghanistan. And just think of that figure for a minute. 1 million soldiers, and they couldn't subjugate these people. And they used every trick in the book. I mean, everything from mass killings and carpet bombings. What we're doing is tame by comparison, considerably tame. And we're having one hell of a fight. And I want to ask the audience, if you're thinking about that we may be going to another war, that this war is going to continue, I want to ask you, think about you sending your son or daughter to Afghanistan, to Iraq, to Iran. If you can say to yourself, honestly, that you are willing to see your son or daughter come home in a body bag, then mazel tov to you. Mazel tov. You know what? Absolutely. Support an intervention in Iran. But I want you to honestly say to yourself that you are willing to send your son or daughter to war.
And with that, Ken, you're going to be repeating this broadcast on Wednesday. You've got something new cooked up.
The Wednesday, we have something. We'll have something new cooked up for the Wednesday. Yes,
and it's going to be you and March. Gus will still be away.
Let's see now. What is our? Well, today is
August 7th.
Okay, so we won't be on this coming Wednesday.
Oh, you were on last time.
We will be on, the next time we'll be on is in September.
Got it. Okay,
the first Sunday and the first Wednesday of September.
So we fell on the other side.
Yes, it's a little confusing because sometimes it's this Wednesday comes first and sometimes the Sunday comes first, and I have to take a minute to think which month I'm in. Well, we are in Bridgeport, and we're happy to be with you on WPKN 89.5 FM.
Yes, right on the hot spot on the dial tonight. You maintain an archive and a blog of
yes.
What you talk about?
Yes, thanks, Dave. Incontextreport.com. We have an archive of our shows, and that's all where you can read March's latest blogs on the war, on geopolitical strategy, and the blogs of my fellow host, Gus Candavero, and my blogs, too. My name's Ken McDermott Rowe.
And I suggest that you use a proxy attach to their connect to their website, so that no one, you delete all traces that you put
on
there.
Everything's on the up and up. I think
thought is sometimes dangerous.
free thought.
Thank you very much for joining us, listeners.
All right, we'll be back with some music for the rest of this evening, and thanks to Ken March for their program. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Got something very special cooked up.